Gene Mack, as I recall, was out of Boston. Not too many people visited the Sporting News offices while Senior Spink was living. And if they did come in, we, the staff, normally did not get to meet them. He prided himself on having exclusive rights, in effect. There were times when a longtime minor league umpire who lived in St. Louis came in and he talked with me, and we talked about the rules and knotty problems and stuff. And occasionally he'd have somebody come out, and Spink would have somebody come out and, in effect, make this visiting umpire feel that I was busy and couldn't spend any more time. There were times I'd be on the phone a little bit long with somebody, and you were there to work.
Has anybody ever written a book on Spink?
No, there was talk, several of people talked about that, but I think the answer, and this is said somewhat facetiously, but pretty seriously too, the only people who would be interested in it would be the sports writers who would expect a free copy, because you couldn't believe the guy. In fact, there was, Bob Gregg used to talk about writing a stage play about this guy. He was so unbelievable, so unusual.
Was he independently wealthy, or did he apparently rely on the newspaper?
Apparently he was independently wealthy.
Okay.
Now, by what amount, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
He positioned himself when we moved in, I believe we moved in December of 45 to new offices at 2018 Washington, a big old warehouse type building that I believe had been headquarters for an electric manufacturing company. We had pretty nice offices there and air conditioning for the first time, if you can believe it. In the old place, boy, I found out what a nose was for. It was for the perspiration to run down.
Yeah, St. Louis is unbelievable.
But anyway, when we moved there, and I've lost my train of thought now, he set up the office so that he was no more than 15, well, he was, his office, and immediately outside of his office was the editorial staff. And he left his door open all the time so he could see you. Didn't want to clear your desk or he'd feel you had nothing to do. In fact, he would often send his secretary out of the office into an adjoining office to look through the glass windows over the shoulder of his number one man to see if he had enough work. If not, he'd then send the secretary out to the composing room, have the head proofreader come in, tell him to get some proofs, and give them to bring proofs into him, to Spink, and Spink would mark, rewrite the heads and give them to the editor. Rewrite the heads that somebody else had written just to keep him busy. Well, he believed in getting his money's worth.
Well, can we jump ahead a little bit here?
Okay.
I know you were the baseball historian, the Hall of Fame historian, from 69 to 82.
Right.
Now, in between there, you were involved or PR director with North American Soccer Hall of Fame?
That was Soccer League. It was a soccer league.
I have a Hall of Fame.
No.
Was that in Oneonta?
No.
No.
It was New York City. Again, it was not the Hall of Fame. There was no Hall of Fame at that point.
Okay.
What happened briefly, about 65, after the World Series of 65, the head proofreader died. So now there's nobody and the head proofreader made up all of the books. Actually, physically, took the type and made up the books. So now we have nobody except me who has had experience on these books, and I can't handle the printing end. So Johnson Spink was in charge. I was put in charge of all of the publications that we had other than the Sporting News, and given a printer. So now we have the Basketball Association, National Basketball League book, some football record book, I believe, and all of the baseball books. I'm in charge of them. And then early in 1966, early in the season, Johnson Spink called me in his office. He wanted to get out a football register, like the baseball register. And he gave me two or three galley sheets that somebody else had arranged for, and it looked like chicken scratching, because they used the same headings for everybody. It would be like using the same headings for batters and pitchers.
Mm-hmm.
The batters would have no pitching, right?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we had a young intern working there, they didn't call him an intern, who later wound up, and I believe is still with the National Football League, and we had a young fellow named John Duxbury. So between the, among the three of us, we worked out a format. Oh, I told Johnson that I didn't want to do it if we weren't going to get it out that fall. At one point he said, well, we'll be that much farther ahead. I said, you're not going to get it out this year. I'd rather wait until the end of the season when I'm free of all this baseball work, and then we can concentrate. No, we'll get it out. So among the three of us, we worked up a format. Johnson Spink gave us, brought in all of the linotypists on a couple Saturdays. These guys knocked it out, and we got that book out, which even the editor of the Sporting News thought was very unusual, how I arranged to get this overtime and got this book out. Anyway, I had often thought of getting into the administrative end of baseball. Had a couple, well, thought I had an opportunity or two. Had an opportunity in Denver, I know, but didn't pay enough money. And...
You mean running a team?
As an assistant to the guy who was running the team.
Okay.
Jim Burrows, who was running the team. He had worked one summer at the Sporting News, and later told me, if I ever get a job where I can hire somebody, you're the man I want. Anyway, in the spring of 67, my wife was president of the pinch hitters in St. Paul's. Pinch hitters are the wives of ball players, executives, media people. Good organization, raises a lot of money each year for the charity. She was invited to go to spring training for 3 days because one gal couldn't go, so she got to go down there, and when she comes home, boy, she had the biggest experience of her life. And the two daughters, they're baseball fans, they're young, but boy, the next year we're going to spring training. Well, a few weeks later, I get a call from Dick Walsh, who had been one of the vice presidents of the Los Angeles Dodgers. I had known him for some time. He had taken the job as commissioner of this new soccer league. I didn't know that. Told me he had tried to get a PR guy out of the media in New York. Nobody was interested. Would I be interested? Well, we talked it over, and the upshot was I took the job with the verbal understanding that if he went back in baseball, I'd go with him. So I was in soccer for 2 years. At the end of the second year, the league essentially folded. He got a job as general manager of the Angels, 7-year contract, but said he couldn't take me along because Gene Autry's boyhood friend was PR there, et cetera, et cetera. So in the meantime, I was asked by Charlie Seeger, who was the assistant to the commissioner, would I be interested in working in the commissioner's office? I didn't know in what capacity, yeah. That didn't work out because the unknown soldier, General Eckert, was fired. At the meeting in San Francisco in 68. So I was, in effect, without a job. I did some part-time work for a few months. And then Lee Allen died, and I had a call from Charlie Seeger that the Hall of Fame was looking for somebody. That's how I wound up in Cooperstown.
Okay. Yeah, I must have miscopied that from Total Baseball, unless they had it wrong. But
you'll have to look it up.
I have to look that up, yeah, because it's at Soccer Hall of Fame. And in my mind, I knew the Soccer Hall of Fame was in Oneonta,
right
down the road from Cooperstown.
Right.
So I thought maybe that's how you got to Cooperstown.
Well, there was I don't know if there was even a thought of a Hall of Fame in Oneonta when I came up here.
You didn't start that up?
Nope.
Okay. So you wound up at Cooperstown at the Hall of Fame, and what was your first job there?
Ooh, I really had no assignment as such. I had to try to find the missing pieces. I had to try to find out what Lee Allen had been doing, and I sort of made up my own job. One of the first real assignments was to put out a new booklet for the Hall of Fame. They were using the same one that they had used since, I guess, 39, and it had hair on it. So I designed it more or less. We had a design outfit, but I laid out the rough design, wrote virtually everything that was in there. As I recall, the production cost was going to be 90 cents a copy for the number of thousand that we had, and the Hall of Fame decided to sell it for $1. To give you an idea of the big profit-making operation it was then versus now.
I The last history of the Hall of Fame I read was in Bill James's book,
right.
The Politics of Glory,
right.
which is
right.
renamed now.
Right.
And I don't remember a lot about that period, but have you read Bill James's
yes.
book?
Yes, I've read that. Yeah.
How does that seem as a history? Is that fairly accurate, or did you disagree?
He wrote it pretty
him?
Well in the way I gave it to him.
Oh, so he talked with you before?
Yes. He was here one winter, a year or so before the book came out, and Tom Heitz had told me he was coming. He said, come on over to the house, bring your wife along. Bill James is going to be here. So Tom and Bill and I sat, and we talked about a lot of this. So a lot of the history of the organization was from that meeting.
Okay. So you're pleased with the way Bill James...
Oh, yeah. What he wrote about me, anyway. He wrote nice things about me. Yeah,
I don't have that book myself, or I would have looked that up.
You should read that.
I read the book.
Oh.
I took it out of the library.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know.
No, he was very complimentary to me. The only thing, and I've never written him, I should, I guess. It's hard to get in touch with him, etc., because he's busy. The only thing that I didn't appreciate too much, and this is not his fault, he got a little mixed up on why I was fired. He thought it had something to do with the theft of Hall of Fame material that was in the commissioner's office. I had absolutely no responsibility for that material. I hadn't even been told what material specifically had been sent down there. I did happen to find out about this stolen material through my good friend Bill Weiss, and I had virtually the whole story right in front of me when they fired me. And after they fired me, they wanted to know what this was all about, and I said I didn't think it was worth discussing. And the president says, I don't either. And then 4 months later, the Sporting News carried a big feature, about 8 pages on.
Did you go to the Sporting News with any information, or did it just happen to the
Sporting News sent their men out to find out. They,
oh, I see.
They apparently knew something about it, too, because Bill Weiss knows the people at the Sporting News.
Yeah. Well, I first visited the Hall of Fame in 1964, and it was quite smaller than it is now in terms of the displays and so on. So it's really changed quite a bit. When you got there in 69, what were some of your first impressions of the Hall?
Old, antiquated, outdated. One of the first ideas I had, and it's not an original idea, our older daughter went to Oberlin College. We went to pick her up, or take her out, I'm not sure which it was. And I said to my wife, we're going to stop at the Football Hall of Fame, because I know Don Smith, the PR guy.
I've been there.
The first impression, you walk up this circular staircase, and here on each of the pillars is half of a helmet and something else. Attractive. So I said something to Don about this, and he said, yeah, we didn't have anything on the Buffalo Bills. Some visitor came from Buffalo, and they want to know about the Buffalo Bills, and we have nothing. Because they hadn't won a game yet, I'm exaggerating, but they were that poor at the time. And so I guess Don came up with this idea, and I came back to Cooperstown and said, we need a Baseball Today display here. These old artifacts are great, but you should have something on today's baseball. The uniforms, they didn't even have the uniforms of the team. And the director at the time said, oh, everybody's seen these uniforms. Nobody's ever seen them up close, and all 24, or however many there were at the time, all together. And so anyway, one of my first contributions was to get all the uniforms, and they put them in cases about this size, all of them stuffed in there. Then a year later, they cleared out the basement storage room because they had received, or were to receive, the George Weiss material. George Weiss had died, and the Hall of Fame was the benefactor of the material. Now they have the basement cleared out, and they find out they can't touch the George Weiss material because the state's still in probate. What are they going to do with this big room? I said, let's put Baseball Today in there. And we had a case, you've probably seen them, about 3 feet wide on each team, had a uniform, picture of the manager, picture of the stadium, picture of a couple players, the yearbook, the media guide, a nice display on each of the 24 teams. That was opened about Hall of Fame weekend of whatever year that was, 73 or 74, I believe. Now comes the wintertime, and there's nothing in the middle. What are we going to put in the middle? So the curator and I got together. Tom Seaver, Pete Rose were the outstanding two in the National League. Nolan Ryan, I forget who, Reggie Jackson in the American League. Okay, we'll get material on them. So I arranged to get the material, and we had a big display on that. So anyway, in my judgment, the three most interesting things in the Hall of Fame at that point, Babe Ruth was definitely, Baseball Today, which was in the basement, Babe Ruth was on the third floor, and the movies, I believe, held in the baseball library. And around that time, too, a little earlier than this Baseball Today exhibit, they bought Danny's Market, property between the, what was the old, what was the museum then, and the Five and Dime, the name of that?
Newberry's.
Newberry's, yes. They bought that property. They're going to expand, and then we modernize the place a little bit.
What was the library like back then?
When you were there, there was just a room where everything was thrown on the floor, I understand.
Well, I didn't visit the library in 64. I didn't. Yeah.
My understanding is, there's a young gal in Ohio who's writing her thesis on the history of the library. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is it was Lee Allen had one little office, and that was it. That was the library, yeah. Things were strewn on the floor, etc. The library was pretty nice, I thought, when I came there, except it wasn't air conditioned. They eliminated that to save money, and then a year later put it in, and cost even more than it would have been. But I thought it was quite adequate.
Okay, now, you had been there a year or two when Sabre started.
Right.
And I wanted to ask you to talk about the beginning of Sabre, because you were one of the original members, right?
Yes.
Were you the only one from Cooperstown?
Yes.
Okay.
I received a letter from Bob Davids. I knew the name. I didn't know that I had met him. He said we met a time or two when he stopped in St. Louis during the war, I believe. Anyway, he had suggested that he thought it'd be interesting to start an organization like this, and wanted to know what I thought and did I know of anybody. And I thought, hey, this is a good idea, wrote him to that effect, had the names of some of the people who had worked with Lee Allen biographical research, gave him those names. Later he called me up and said, we'd like to meet in Cooperstown on this particular date. Can we arrange it? Is it possible to meet in the library? I made the arrangements. We met there. We had 16 people, I believe, is what it was, and things worked out from there.
Are you looking forward to the anniversary this summer?
Oh, this is what, the 25th anniversary?
Yeah. I think there's,
my understanding is there's going to be something, yeah.
Be a ceremony.
See, I was out of Sabre from 87 through, I guess, 94, for certain reasons. There were certain political things that, before you joined it, that were not good.
I have a vague, knowledge of that, but I'm not interested in probing that.
Yeah.
If you'd like to say anything for the record,
well, right ahead. Let's follow up a little bit. The first, we met here in Cooperstown, then the next year we met in suburban Washington, as I recall, and it was just one day. I drove down, there had been big floods, just as there had been this past week, and getting through Harrisburg posed the possibility of a problem. I got there. I don't remember too much about the meeting, but anyway, the first year we had a president, vice president, and a secretary treasurer, I believe it was. The second year, Dr. Stan Grosshandler was named secretary treasurer. He lived in suburban Milwaukee. At the end of Sabre's second year, Stan Grosshandler moved to, I believe it's Raleigh, North Carolina, to the Research Triangle, a medical center. At the end of the third year, at our meeting, at the annual meeting, and just a small group of officers, he said, this is ridiculous. People must think Sabre's like a traveling crap game. He said, I'm still getting letters addressed to the first secretary. I'm getting letters addressed to me in Milwaukee, suburban Milwaukee. And now the headquarters was listed as the office of the home of the secretary treasurer. And he says, we're growing. I think we should be able to afford to hire somebody to handle. And he said, besides, I can't keep financial books. Can't even add my own checkbook.
Now, did you have, from the very beginning, you planned to have a membership, a dues-paying membership?
Yes. Okay. I think from the very beginning, it was a dues-paying membership. I'm not sure what the dues were originally, whether they were $10 or $20. But anyway, we had a small amount of money. It was pretty small. It had about 100 members. Bob Davis was handling virtually everything on the editorial end.
Now, as I recall from reading, he had been publishing something himself, a four-page newsletter,
yeah,
Baseball
right.
Greed.
Once a year.
Now, did...
About once a year.
Did he continue to do that, or did...
He continued
did that
to do that.
Official Saber publication?
No,
or?
He continued to do that on his own. At one point, we talked about somehow tying it in with the Saber publication.
But was there a Saber newsletter from the beginning? What was the benefit of being
a publication. There was a Saber newsletter. Bob Davis got that out. I'm not sure if it was monthly. I have all the copies, I think. I don't remember whether it was monthly or not. Well, anyway, at the end of the third year at this meeting, Gross Handler says, this is ridiculous. It looks like a traveling crack game to people who are interested, and we should be able to afford. So I was asked, could I find somebody in Cooperstown? Gee, it'd be great to have a Cooperstown address for Saber. I thought of a lady down the street, a block down the street, who had retired from working at the Hall of Fame. I realized, hey, she's 66, 67, maybe a little older. She's retired. She won't have the vaguest idea of some of the questions these people will be asking. I thought of a sister-in-law of one of our daughters. She's about four blocks away, but she won't know anything. These questions are going to come in. I want to join. I want to know this. She can't answer that. Who am I going to send it to? I'm almost going to have to answer it. So I said to my wife, how about you being the secretary? They weren't paying much. It was $1 a member, I think, to keep the books and stuff. But I said, I'm really not making much of a contribution to Saber the way Bob David, Bob McConnell, and some of the others are, because I don't know if there's a conflict of interest. I don't want to create a conflict of interest as far as the Hall of Fame is concerned. But I said, hey, I come home for lunch every day. We can open the mail, and if there's anything, I can handle it. I usually stayed an hour after 5 o'clock after quitting time. I can handle these things. So she reluctantly agreed, and that's how Cooperstown happened to become the Saber headquarters. And then about 81, I suggested we were growing. We were up to over 1,000 men, I believe, that, hey, it's time to think of about the possibility of an executive director. And then when I got canned at the Hall of Fame the following spring, they decided, well, yeah, I asked them not to publish the salary that they were offering because I was really ashamed of it, but they insisted they had to tell the membership what it was going to be, get the membership to approve the idea. And so I ran it from 83 through 85 when I got my fill of the guy, the president, who was going to take over as Hitler and run the organization. Ask John Thorne. You know John Thorne?
I met him in Pittsburgh.
No.
I don't know.
John and I were very close at that time. We worked together in great ideas that he came up with. But we were convinced we were going to have 10,000 members within a few years, and they never come close.
What is it now, about six?
Six, yeah, about seven? Six. It's just a little over six, I think. But a lot of people have dropped out, and things, well, I don't know.
Well, baseball's had some rough times, too, right?
Yeah.
I think that's a factor, I you know, just the overall interest in baseball.
Yeah.
Since this, right?
I tried, I quit at the meeting in early September, I believe, of 1985. But they got me to agree to stick through October, and so I missed the World Series, St. Louis versus Kansas City. I had plans to go, I had all arrangements made, and the morning that I was due to leave, I called up my friend and said, I can't make it, I gotta finish up this Saber stuff. I wrote a few people, just a few, that winter, to see what their feelings were about some of the things that were going on. And at the convention in Chicago in 86, I spent virtually all of my time meeting with five or six people who could have had an effect on the situation. Three of whom, and I picked them out specifically because they were attorneys. They were members, but they were attorneys, so they would know the legal things to consider. And they met with the guy who was, in my judgment, and judgment of others have since agreed, who is the problem. And anyway, he was ready to step aside, but didn't. So the whole thing came to a climax, I understand, in Albany in 89.
Before my time.
Yeah, right.
I really enjoyed being a member, and I think I've recruited a few people in.
Yeah, I've recruited a few also. Yeah. In fact, when I was running it, I recruited quite a number of baseball people. It used to be the custom to hold a little Sabre regional meeting on Hall of Fame weekend. One year, Carl Erskine was here. Some Dodger was inducted. Carl was here. I met him, talked to him. Hey, how about talking at our Sabre regional? Well, he's a guest of Peter O'Malley. So, he said he'd check with Peter. Anyway, we just barely had started our meeting. I think it was Bill Jenkinson of Philadelphia was giving a presentation, the first presentation on longest home runs. That was one of his specialties. Went in the door of the funeral home where we hold the meeting.
I've been to a couple of them.
Came Peter O'Malley and Carl Erskine. So as soon as Jenkinson was finished, I introduced both of them and put Erskine on, and he talked a little while. As they had to depart immediately to get to the hotel in time for dinner, just about closing hour for dinner hour. And I talked to Peter just briefly. Anyway, a little while later, I get $40 from him for his membership and Erskine's membership. So I got quite a few baseball people in. There was a feeling at the time, I think, among some people that, gee, why do we want people like that as members? But they add prestige to the organization, I feel. And if the dues are properly structured, every additional member means a little extra money for the organization with which it can do other projects.
Yeah, and I'm sure some of the players and their families are interested in the publication.
Oh, some of them were really sure. Very interested.
You can see that at the Sabre conventions, I think, when
right.
The players right. Come to the convention.
Yeah,
so they get real excited, you know, just being around baseball people.
Right.
And people care about the game. I mean,
that's my
experience, right. The panelists and the questions they get. I think they really enjoy it, because it's not the, it's not the same old questions they got in the locker
right.
room, and it's not the same old questions they get when they're interviewed on the 6 o'clock news.
Plus, it's not just plain collectors who are interested in their autographs
right.
and stuff.
Right. But they, all of a sudden they're there, and this group of people, they know a lot about them, and
right.
they ask these questions maybe that they
right.
Haven't talked about crazy. Do you have to get going? Okay, maybe we can try and wrap it up by 4. See how we're in good shape there. I have a little note here that you were in charge of the biographical committee for Sabre for a
yes,
while.
Yes, now, the background of that is Lee Allen had called me about 63-64. He was here at the Hall of Fame. I was with the Sporting News. He called me to see whether I might be interested in leaving the Sporting News to join him in compiling a publication which turned out to be the Baseball Encyclopedia. I'm sure that's what he had in mind. I remember him mentioning IBM and computers, etc. Well, it was so nebulous that I certainly am not going to leave a good job to. And as a sideline, I asked him one time how he was doing here at Hall of Fame. He says, they don't pay me anything. He got something, but he had to write a book a year, he said, to make ends meet. Well, anyway, so nothing came about. But in the meantime, he had started this research group, Joe Simonek and some autograph collectors who had the addresses. But the idea was to get questionnaires on all the players so that he could put out the encyclopedia. Now, how David Neft and his group got into the picture, I don't know. Maybe Lee had contact with David, but I'm sure it was mutually agreeable the way things worked out for ICI, which was David Neft and group, Information Concepts Corporation, I believe it was called. And I don't know if David Neft headed it, he headed the work they did. I think it was a separate corporation, and they undertook the project of putting out, with the help of Macmillan, this first encyclopedia. But anyway, so David Neft, the benefits that were derived from this biographical research. Lee provided the biographical data for this encyclopedia. And then when I came to the Hall of Fame, as they say, I had to pick up the loose pieces. I didn't even know about this. The librarian knew just a little bit, but I wrote to Simonick and some of the others, found out what had happened, and therefore pursued the biographical research. I felt it was valuable for the Hall of Fame record, if nothing else. Mm-hmm. And then later on, we realized that there was possibility of making a little money selling this data to Macmillan for future encyclopedias, and Sabre did that. What the arrangement is now, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. I know some people new to baseball research are surprised that there's Total Baseball as well as the Big Mac or the Macmillan Encyclopedia. And I see John Thorne and Pete Palmer on Total Baseball, and I know Sabres had a lot to do with Total Baseball, too.
Right.
How would you respond to that? If somebody asked you, why is there two? Could they be combined into one?
They could be combined.
Do you feel it's better that there's actually a competition to produce a...
I'm not sure that it is better to have competition. And I'll cite this as an example. I can show you probably 10 different lifetime records of Walter Johnson, showing 10 different totals of strikeouts, maybe 5 different totals of victories. Mm-hmm. And this is true of many other players. Now, which is correct? You as a baseball fan just getting into this type of thing, which is the correct one, you ask me? You wonder, you mm-hmm. ask people. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure.
Well, let me ask you this. If I asked you how many strikeouts Walter Johnson had, which book would you send me to, or which one do you like?
I'd send you to both and let you decide which one you want.
Okay.
Number one, Pete Palmer is somewhat of a genius in the compiling of baseball statistics. He's a computer expert and so forth. He devised a lot of this stuff. I believe he was the first one to find Ty Cobb's record in 1911 was wrong, because he went through the official statistical sheet of the Hall of Fame and found it. John Thorne is a great baseball brain. So they combined and probably said to themselves, hey, I think there is a market for a baseball encyclopedia better, in our judgment, Pete's and John's, than the baseball encyclopedia by Macmillan. They sold somebody on the idea. They have statistics in there that the Baseball Encyclopedia does not have.
Yeah, I own both books, by the way, and I find them both very helpful.
Right.
It's when they disagree with each other, that's when you say, well, I have to go back and do it myself. You
know? Well, this goes back to something else that I touched on very briefly at the meeting, the Sabre meeting. I don't know if you sat in on it, when they were talking about whether to include forfeited games in the averages.
Yeah.
And I made the point there needs to be a good records committee. And I had association with two records committees. In 1957, at Colorado Springs winter minor league meetings, there was a records committee. It functioned only a year or two. Nobody funded, etc. And then in 1975, Joe Reichler, then the assistant to the commissioner, presumably got the commissioner's approval to start up a records committee. And I thought we made some progress. That folded and ended when the Lajoie question came up, the 1911, I believe, Lajoie-Cobb. Again, there was no funding, and I guess I can say that I did most of the work with the help of Bob Soderman, Joe Simonick, a bunch of Sabre members. Most of the work that was done by the committee, made the presentations and got a few things accepted. Along that line, Bob Soderman found that Hack Wilson had 191 RBIs instead of 190. One RBI, or one game, the RBI was given to somebody else. That was not approved by the committee. I think I had presented that just about the time the committee did an El Foldo Act.
Now, there is some committee, isn't there, that deals with some... I'm thinking last year they had the extra RBI for Roger Maris, which gave him a tie, or was it...
Retrosheet found that just recently, but I don't know that that's gone before a committee.
Okay.
Yes, another committee was named a few years ago, and a very estimable, is that the right word, a very esteemed gentleman. But I don't think they know anything about records.
Mm.
David Voigt was one of them. David's a fairly good friend of mine. I don't have much contact with him, but we've met many times. And he's a bright, very bright guy, knows baseball. But you got to know about the backgrounds of these records, how they came about. For example, when we started the committee in 75, Ralph Kiner was on. I think it was Ralph. I may be wrong, but I think it was Ralph. How could it be wrong? It's been in the record books all these years. Well, now, how did it get in the record book, on whose authority, and what was the background?
Well, you must have run into this problem with the Sporting News when you put out, like, one for the book.
Yes, to some extent. Well, see, I didn't have too much to do with the actual figures in the book. Most of them were handled by Gettleson, so I didn't have much to do with that kind of stuff. Again, I essentially arranged to see if what he sent in was done and made some decisions on when teams were removed, how we'll handle those records. I can't think of anything offhand other than maybe that Lajoie and Waddell that I was involved that affected one for the book. Because again, I didn't spend much time on records. Well, I didn't mention earlier, essentially my job at the Sporting News in the summer was the Triple A's. It started with some of the more than Triple A's, but wound up with the Triple A's. In the fall, I would handle the Winter League, make all the arrangements, usually rewrite everything that was sent in had to be rewritten. I rewrote most of it. Sometimes I'd have others help me. And then worked on the guide and the other books. And, the Winter League.
The rest. Okay.
Did a lot of jumping around.
Yes, we did. Well, that's what I don't really have an outline, but I just made all these notes here. I have a feeling we could talk forever. Let me real quick ask you about some of your other baseball memories. Since you were born around 1922, I guess?
21.
When did you start following the game? What are your earliest memories?
My earliest recollection of baseball was about 1933. Quakertown's 40 miles outside of Philadelphia. Sunday baseball was not permissible at that time, so the major leagues didn't play, but several people living right near me, right on our block, started up a local team, and they made arrangements for the Philadelphia Athletics to come to Quakertown to play a Sunday exhibition. It poured cats and dogs on Saturday night. When we got home from church, which was about 8 miles out of town, when we got home at Sunday about noon, we stopped at the ballpark, which was a block from our home. The field was in beautiful condition. Nobody's there. The game had been called off. Connie Mack had let his players go because of the rain. The players went to Atlantic City, etc. Our people, I understand, offered to drive to Philadelphia to pick them up, players up, but Connie said couldn't get a team together. The question was, could Jimmy Fox, that powerful slugger, hit the ball over the cow shed in left field? The baseball diamond was on the edge of the fairground. The cow shed must have been 400 feet from left field. So that was one of my earliest recollections. And then a year or two later, the local team got into the semi-pro East Penn League, which had a lot of ex-major leaguers, including, and I didn't realize this until just recently, that one of them was a member of the 1919 Cincinnati Reds, who won the Black World Series. Mm-hmm. A guy named Eddie Gerner, who was around 40-some years old, a good hitter. He had been a pitcher earlier. A good hitter was playing in that league. Elmer Vallo started in that league a year before he went to professional baseball. Ron Northey started. Ray Narleski, the father of Ray... Was it Ray the pitcher?
He pitched, yeah.
With the Bill Narleski. Bill Narleski, an infielder with the Braves and other teams. A lot of ex-minor leaguers playing in this league. So it was pretty fast semi-pro baseball. Mm-hmm. A kid of 15, 16 thought.
Okay. So you wouldn't have any memories of the called shot in 1932?
Oh, no. I knew.
How about the Gas House Gang?
The Gas House Gang, I think, were one of the first major league references that intrigued me, the Gas House Gang. So I got interested in them, and 35, I can remember running home from school late in the season in September and picked up a Cardinal-Cub game, I think it was, when the Cubs were overcoming the Cardinals, raced home again the next day, and I couldn't get it on the radio. So they're among my earliest recollections.
Did you listen to the World Series at that time?
I was in school. I do remember. I think I listened to one of the World Series during study hall.
Do you have any radio memories of that seventh game of the World Series when the Cardinals defeated the Tigers and Medwick got called to the
garbage? No, I don't remember any of that. I remember reading about it, but I don't remember any radio.
I just wondered how that sounded over the radio. So you were following the game when Lou Gehrig's streak was ended.
Right.
And he had his farewell.
Right. He was one of my favorite players.
You got to see him play.
No, I never got to see him
play.
No,
that's right. I think he did get to St. Louis later.
Yeah. Well, I might have, that day in Shy Park, I might have seen him, but I don't know who played. I don't remember a thing about it.
Yeah, it's too bad you didn't get to see that Connie Mack team, because that was quite a dynasty there. I mean, that they were all together. Like Simmons and Fox.
I was a little young at that time. And Philadelphia was a long way away.
How about DiMaggio's streak? You weren't with the Sporting News yet, but you might have remembered that.
I remember reading about it, not much beyond that. Mm-hmm. Again, at that time, most of my memories were about from having read things. I don't remember. Well, let's see. My earliest radio memories, Philadelphia A's and Phillies games. In fact, right after getting out of high school, I tried to get a job as a statistician with some of the broadcasters, and at one point thought I was close. That didn't work out.
Who was your favorite broadcaster at the time? Or did you have a broadcaster that kind of hooked on baseball?
Yeah, there was Bill Dyer was with the A's, Byron Song was with the A's. Mm-hmm. I believe maybe they did A's and Phillies. I think they did just home games for a number of years before anybody went on the road. They were, WOR, I can't remember the name of them. This was not play-by-play, though. This was just a sportscast. Remember, I had a battle. I had four siblings younger than me. And
didn't have your own radio.
Didn't have my own radio. And most of the baseball would come on at the end of the news during dinner hour, which didn't please my family to have me go listen to the radio.
Were your parents baseball fans?
Slight fans. I can remember my dad building a screen to put in front of the straight up and down and straight across windshield. You remember the old cars without curved windshield?
Hmm.
So we'd pull up at the right field corner of the fence at the fairgrounds and watch the game from there because he couldn't afford the 25 cents or 10 cents it cost to get in. Like Louie Kuhn, one of my early jobs was hanging numbers on the scoreboard.
Really?
My brothers stood on ladders behind the fence and chased foul balls that went out of the park. 15 cents a game. Big money in those days.
Yeah, I never did the scoreboard thing. I saw it done just a couple years ago. We were traveling through the old Durham Athletic Park.
Oh, yeah.
And they were still doing it then. I know they had somebody out behind there operating the bull. Maybe it was left time. I just remember somebody up in the scoreboard and watching them.
One interesting recollection from the days when I hung the numbers in the scoreboard, one rival team in the semi-pro league had three outfielders named Wellaj, W-E-L-A-J, and it seemed to me they played more shallow than any trio of outfielders I saw. Many years later, Evelyn and I and our daughters went on vacation to Washington. And I said to her one day, hey, we're going to the ballpark. Well, I looked in the paper and they had just finished their homestay. I said, well, we'll go to the ballpark anyway. I'd like to meet some of the guys there. I met Johnny Wellaj.
Okay.
Anyway, we went to the ballpark. I met Johnny Wellaj. That was the first time. And I happened to mention this to him. He had played Major League Baseball. I believe he played it later on.
How do you spell that name?
W-E-L-A-J. Johnny Wellaj. He only played a year or two, but he's worked for the Washington and Texas clubs. In fact, he may still be working for the Texas club down in Port Charlotte in Florida. I think he lives down there now, but he worked for the club for years and years and years, traveling secretary and other positions of that kind. And yeah, he remembers that real well, that they three brothers played. They came from someplace in Jersey to play in the outfield.
Speaking of obscure players, I noticed that the article in
not particularly. What happened there was, soon after the first Macmillan Encyclopedia came out, David Neff and several of his co-compilers were in town, and we talked about the various things they had found, including some of these phantoms. And so, well, let's make a record of them.
Maybe you should define a phantom for the listeners who haven't
phantom
read the article.
Phantom ball players turned out to be pseudonyms, really, pseudonyms for some actual ball players. Sometimes a kid was still in college and he didn't want the college to find out, so he'd play under another name, or sometimes the linotypist would type it in correctly. Sometimes the printer would make a correction in the wrong box score, and consequently a player who never played with a team is listed in the box score for this other team. So there are all kinds of phantoms came up.
And you started collecting them?
Anyway, I made a list of those, and when John Thorne decided to come out with this Total Baseball book, he offered me the opportunity to write a number of articles if I wanted to. I just didn't quite have the ambition to do a lot of writing at that time, but I volunteered to do the one on phantom ballplayers and tried to pull together as best I could all of these notes that I had. And most of them came from David Neff. Give credit to the proper person who had found a lot of these. I pursued the research on some of them, of course, and that was the background of that article.
Are Sabre members still finding phantoms, even as we speak? Or do you think they've been mostly discovered by now?
I think most of them have been discovered, but there's still some questions come up occasionally. Just recently, Bob Folks of Minneapolis area wrote me to ask about a pitcher named Betts who pitched for St. Louis Nationals in 1903, I believe it was, in 1911 or 13 with the Cincinnati Reds, one game each time. Bill Haber, the late Bill Haber, who was one of the greatest researchers on biographical research, originally came up with information that showed the guy with Cincinnati was Fred Betts, a typewriter salesman, according to one article. I think maybe that reference was facetious, but anyway, in looking him up just recently again to confirm some of my notes, he was listed as Fred Betts, George Betts, Hal Betts, all different names, but it turned out that the official records kept by the then equivalent of the commissioner's office showed it was Harold Betts pitched with Cincinnati, and we know it was Harold Betts who pitched for St. Louis back in, I think it was 3-13 rather than 3-11. So anyway, the reason folks inquired was that he was compiling a list of all of the biographical research reports, putting everything in alphabetical order, and wanted us to get that squared away.
Did you ever run into a ball player that officially changed their name?
There have been several, yes, but not as phantom ball players. They changed their name. Everybody knew that they changed their name either before they entered baseball or after they entered baseball.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I don't. But again, there still are some questions. One of them that I just worked on recently, because the question was posed in the biographical research newsletter by some other researcher, a fellow named James Irwin Adams. I'd have to look up the exact dates. Pitched with St. Louis, as it turned out, in the early 1900s, then in Pittsburgh Federals, and then with Philadelphia Americans. With Philadelphia, he was known as Bill Adams. It turns out, from everything I've been able to find, and this comes from one of his sons, that his proper name was James Irwin Adams II, same as his father,
death certificate shows that. The son with whom I corresponded is James Irwin Adams III. But somehow, Adams, the pitcher, became known as Bill Willie William early, apparently early in his career, maybe even while he was in college. And so at times, he was referred to simply as William Adams. In fact, a member of the family, this is three or four generations down, still has envelopes and letters from Connie Mack addressed to William Adams. But his proper name was James Irwin, I-R-V-I-N, Adams.
Now, do you get over to the Hall of Fame Library now?
I stop there quite often on a Tuesday. I go in town on Tuesday for Rotary meetings, have a little time before Rotary and spend time there, do some research on my own or answering the Adams Betts situations, and also that New York Yankees Phantom Triple Play, worked on that. Yeah, I get there occasionally.
Are you still doing research on new things?
No, I'm cutting back a little bit because my basement library, family room down there is in such disarray that I should spend hours and hours just trying to get that straightened out. Meantime, you see that big stack of papers. I get the New York Times after the village library is finished with it. They keep it about a month. I still read that. My wife says, why? And still clip things of interest. I haven't filed them away. I filed all of that stuff.
Do you read either of like Baseball Weekly or Baseball America?
I get Baseball America. I get Baseball Weekly. I get the Sporting News. I get Baseball Magazine, and I get to look through some of them sometimes. Yeah. And Sports Illustrated. I don't read the things the way I'd like to.
Yeah.
I keep buying baseball books that I hope someday to get to read. So with all of that, I just discourage myself a little bit in trying to spend too much time on research.
And you still get to the Sabre conventions. I mean, you went to the last one, obviously.
I'd gone to everyone through 85 and then was induced to go to the last one by a friend of mine with whom I go to the World Series and All-Star games regularly.
Well, maybe I'll see you again there or down here. Now, do you go to the regional Sabre meetings in Cooperstown?
I have the last few years, yeah. Yeah,
I did for a couple years, and in the last year or two, I haven't made it.
They're not, well, I don't want to be critical. You have to turn it off.
Okay, we'll pass on that.
They're not structured, really.
No, they you never know. I mean, I never know what to expect. I was entertained very well, the ones that I attended, but like I said, I missed the last two.
Well, just briefly, I had famous umpire. What the heck was his name? I can't. Tom
Gorman?
Tom Gorman. I had him one time. Had, as I mentioned, Carl Erskine. And a number of Sabre members. Now, a lot of Sabre members come on that weekend, but a lot of them come to collect autographs, et cetera, et cetera. So I haven't gotten too many, was unable to get some of them that I would have liked to attend to be there. But I used to try to structure it so we...
If they have the anniversary Sabre meeting in Cooperstown this year, there's bound to be a lot of, Sabre people here.
It depends when they're going to have it, though.
Yeah, I don't know when they're...
Yeah, I don't know anything about that either. Now, they had one, I guess, 5 years ago, that far back. I received notice somehow, and we had a little meeting, maybe an hour, I believe, in one of the rooms of the old baseball library, and had our picture taken out front, and that was about the extent of my recollection of that occasion. Some of them got together to eat out, I suppose. Again, I don't know anything beyond that.
Okay, well, why don't we... wrap it up there.
Yeah, I guess
get to your meeting, and I can get back to it. So, thanks very much.
All right.
Any final words?
Lots of ruckus, they say.
What have you learned from baseball? What have you learned from baseball? What's the main message of baseball?
I enjoyed my years in it. I was very, very lucky, I think. And of course, I worked hard, so. Luck is a residue of design? Is that what Brant Shirky used to say?
He got credit for it if he didn't say it.
Right.
Okay. Well, we'll stop it there.
All right.
All right, we have a postscript here.
One quick recollection, and of course, I'm breaking my arm, patting myself on the back indirectly, I suppose, by bringing this up. But 1972 was the baseball meetings, major and minor, were in Hawaii. I suggested to the Hall of Fame that it might be worth my going on behalf of the Hall of Fame. The response, I don't think, has yet come through. I decided I couldn't pass up $250 fare round trip from New York City to Hawaii, special cheap room rates at one of the beachfront hotels arranged by Bob Feller, who was then working for Sheraton, I believe. And so my wife and I both went. Now, to be honest, I was later reimbursed at least part of this, maybe most of it, by the Hall of Fame, because they found out I did some
This would make my wife a baseball fan.
Well, my wife was already a baseball fan. Anyway, there was a movie, of course, shown on the plane from here to San Francisco, where we stopped to refuel. Now we're out over the Pacific, right, not the Atlantic, Pacific. Another movie comes on, and people are getting a little tired of sitting there and antsy. And I look in the back of the plane, and there are four or five gentlemen, including Frank Cashin, the then general manager of the Orioles. I had known Frank. So I decided, hey, let's get back in the baseball swing of things. I went back, and Frank Cashin says, geez, why are we going all the way to Hawaii with all of these diversions over there? We should go to some place like Minneapolis, where we had met years ago, where you can't do anything. You can't even get out of a hotel because it's so cold, and do our business and get away. So I said to Frank, how about Cooperstown? There's nothing to do there. He's in the wintertime. You can't get out, no diversions. And he said, no, you couldn't hold the major league meetings there because the owners want to be near an airport where they can get out at a moment's notice, take care of other business that may come up. So I said, hey, how about the general manager's meetings, which had only recently been instituted? Yeah, not a bad idea, he said. And I said, pointed out that almost no baseball people had come to Cooperstown and had any idea what the museum was, what was going on there, knew nothing about the library. The few baseball people who came in usually came in, the occasion would be when they came in with their team to play the exhibition game, and usually they watched the game and then left immediately.
When did that start, by
the games?
Yeah, the exhibition games.
In 1940.
Okay.
39 there were games, but the Major League won AL versus NL was 1940, I believe. Mm-hmm. So anyway, Frank said, yeah, that sounds pretty good. I checked with the big wigs at our place, not bad. I told them, pointed out to them how when the meetings are, and it was usually a week after the hotel would close for its season. The hotel stays open only during the tourist season. In the wintertime, they'd have trouble getting conventions, etc. But I was, as I recall, I was given approval to pursue this.
This is the Otisaga?
Otisaga.
Now, did they make an exception for the general managers, or?
Well, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
So I fixed up a proposal and sent it to Frank Cashin about the general manager's meeting in Cooperstown. Point two was getting Hall of Fame promos on the telecast of all clubs. And the third was a suggestion given me by Hal Middlesworth, a Detroit PR man, for each club to arrange with the manufacturer of its uniforms. When it produces new uniforms for the team, it makes an extra one of the Hall of Fame's exhibit. Sent it to Frank Cashin. The meeting's in Scottsdale, Arizona, as I recall, in 73 or 4. The meetings are normally Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday morning. At the equivalent of noontime Monday, I get a call. It's Frank Cashin. We approve your suggestions. We'll meet in Cooperstown next year if arrangements can be made. Oh, great. Hung up the phone, called the president of the Hall of Fame, whose office was on Wall Street, and who visited Cooperstown three or four times a year, even if it wasn't needed. Mm-hmm. In other words, he wasn't in Cooperstown. Mm-hmm. Told him about it. Oh, we can't keep the Otisaga open 3 or 4 days empty to wait for this meeting. Okay. Hung up the phone. Now, I'm in the middle. What do I do?
Now, did he have a connection with the Otisaga?
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
The Clarks own the Otisaga.
Oh, okay.
As they
I didn't quote, realize who you were talking
yeah,
about.
As they quote unquote the Hall of own the Hall of Fame. Anyway, something tells me he may change his mind. But in fairness to Frank Cashin and the GMs, I gotta respond right away. Called Frank back, told him. Now on Wednesday afternoon or Thursday morning, I believe it was, well, I don't know which it was, I get a call from the president down on Wall Street. Steve Clark has changed his mind. You know who Steve Clark was. He's the big man on the Clark Estates. The president of the Hall of Fame is his employee, even though he gets $1 million a year or something.
Okay.
Now, whether Steve Clark had been brought into it, I don't know, but Steve Clark has changed his mind and will keep the hotel open so that they can accommodate the general managers. Should have gotten something to drink for you and me. Anyway, so I called Baltimore the next morning. Frank has just gotten home. He's not in the office. I got his home number from the operator, called him. Well, he says, I was co-chairman this year, but it's in the hands of new co-chairman now, Phil Segge of Cleveland and Peter Bavese of San Diego. You'll have to call one of them. So I called Phil Segge, Cleveland. Oh, we've already picked out Puerto Rico. And so that was the end of that story. But what I was leading up to, a year, getting a long way, or a year or two later, I had heard that the PR directors were thinking a change should be made in the World Series program arrangements. As you probably know, each club used to get out its own World Series program. And sometimes a race would go down to the last day. Usually, though, you knew. So usually there were no more than three teams, and usually only two teams had to prepare a World Series program. But now with the playoffs, it was 4, 6, 8, and 10 clubs. And they were spending, they said, as much as $25,000 getting ready for a program, and they didn't even get in the series. $25,000 is not much money now, but back then it was a lot of money. So somebody came up with, a publisher in San Francisco, came up with the idea of putting out a program that any of the four playoff contenders could use. And the PR guys wanted me to be the editor of the thing. So I was asked to be the editor and edited the first four programs put out by, in effect, the commissioner's office, 74 through 77. That's what this postscript is all about.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know if I have one. The Pirates got in the playoffs one of those years in 75, I think. Four, five, six.
Eastern Division. Don't ask me to remember what's your
Eastern Division. So maybe I can
look
that up. Right. The old number company there. Okay. Well, with that, we'll call it a day here.